I thought I would share with you tonight some thoughts that I've been having recently about a basic problem that we're all facing. And I think it's a fairly serious problem, but I also would like to think that there's a solution to it, or at least an approach to a solution to it. The problem, as I see it, is that there's a really fundamental incompatibility between Buddhism and the primary message of Buddhism and our civilization, our world, our country, our nation, our culture. I'm tempted to call it an American culture, but it's really not just a problem with America. It's really Western civilization as a whole. And for the sake of having to come up with some label, maybe I'll just refer to it as the dominant paradigm, okay? Now, the Buddha, as you all know, 2,500 years ago, was largely arguing against the dominant paradigm of his time. And he came up with a really quite radical and countercultural set of statements and ideas and practices. And, you know, the more I work with this material and the more I inhabit our community, the more disturbed I am that really we don't get it, what he was saying. And I don't think we want to get it. And I'm not sure that we can get it, you know. So what is the it? Well, the key insight, the key teaching, the key message of the Buddha's teaching and practice, as you're all very familiar with, is this notion of the second noble truth, and the third, for that matter. The first truth being that there is such a thing as suffering in our lives, in our experience, in our world. The second noble truth, which is his great insight, is that this suffering has a cause. And that cause is craving, desire. There's a lot of different words we're going to explore for that tonight. But because he sees the desire as the cause of all suffering, the solution to that problem is the cessation of desire. If we didn't have desire, we didn't have craving, we wouldn't suffer. That all makes a lot of sense. And he talks about craving in some very strong language, you know? It's the arrow that pierces us, the dart that, you know, strikes us, the knife that cuts us, the fire that burns us, the poison that is toxic and causes us disease. You know, desire, in one great text, he says that this craving has to be done away with. And how does he describe doing away with craving? You know, it's not enough to just cut it off. You've got to pull craving up from the roots, drag it up out of the depths of the unconscious mind, and take those roots and cut them up into little pieces, you know, and burn them in a fire, and take the ashes and scatter them over the ocean. To the winds. That's how completely we're supposed to destroy craving. And then, with craving gone, desire eradicated, you know, we don't suffer anymore. It's a very clear message. And the culprit in that story is desire. If only we could get rid of desire, we'd be fine. Well, I don't think any of us buy that. I don't think any of us are down with that. I don't think any of us really deep down want to get rid of desire, are really able to see desire as the culprit. That everything in our civilization, in our culture, everything in the dominant paradigm, not only tolerates desire, but celebrates it. I mean, where would Western civilization be without the celebration of desire? you know? It's the narrative in all of our drama, all of our stories, all of our literature. You set up somebody that wants something really badly, but then is thwarted from satisfying that desire because of some convention or some adversary or some obstacle. And then using desire as a tool, they strive to overcome that obstacle, they fulfill their desire, and everything comes to a happy ending. We like desire. And, you know, again and again, you've heard it, and I've heard it from so many people. What's wrong with wanting stuff? What's wrong with liking stuff? What, you know, if we didn't have desire, how would we get anything done? You know, even desiring the end of desire requires desire, you know? What was he talking about? And doesn't this all make it sound very austere and almost, well, devoid of desire? You know, where's the passion? Passion in our civilization is something that we like. We celebrate it. And I don't just mean the commercials on TV about, you know, following your passion and use your passion to motivate you to do great things, you know. There's a sense that without, you know, desire, we can't change the world. And of course, changing the world is really important to us. We're heirs of the Western civilization's outlook, which is that the world out there matters a lot, more than the world in here, which is the early Indian point of view. And that we need to use desire as a useful and creative tool to make changes out there in the world. There's a sense that if we didn't have desire, that things would be very bland. They'd be devoid of any texture, any color, any interest, any enthusiasm, you know? What's with all these statues? Do I have one there? Of the Buddha with this sort of bland look on his face, maybe the hint of a smile. The statues are supposed to have the hint of a smile, that in some ways he's mildly amused by the way we're all impassioned with desire, you know? And so I see this as a problem. As much as we, you know, want to follow in the practice and follow the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, and how many times we can see in our own experience where instances of desire can be transformed and bring about an alleviation of suffering, there's still a basic mismatch between the dominant paradigm and the Buddha's message. And I think we can't help this tension being what it is, to either want to change Buddhism, change the message somehow, to co-opt it somehow so that it fits in to our veneration of desire. And there's some of that afoot. Or, you know, the other option, of course, is to, you know, is there some way that we can transform the dominant paradigm, transform our culture, such that desire and craving becomes less and less important, less and less meaningful, less and less glorified? And we somehow see through the harm that it's doing and learn from Buddhism how to be different in the world. I think we're seeing the first movement a fair amount, that, you know, we're starting to hear things like, well, the Buddha didn't really say that desire was the problem. It's only the attachment to desire that's a problem, you know. It's okay to have desire, you just not get caught by it, you know. Well, you know, that's not the way the Buddha put it, you know. He started the problem with desire itself and how we have to pull out that arrow and how we have to heal the wound that it causes and all the rest of it. We also have discourse these days that are saying, well, this ideal, this Buddhist ideal of dispassion, that it must be in some way disconnecting from anything valuable and important. That these Buddhists are too aloof, too austere, too unengaged, maybe even uninterested, if we're not thrown around by the, you know, by the waves of passion, then we must not be feeling anything valuable, anything worthwhile. What's the point of sitting there with great equanimity and just letting it all be what it is, you know? That's not the way we work with things. We thrive on our discontent with things not being, you know, as just as they should be, or as equitable as they should be, or as noble as they should be. And we thrive on sort of putting our shoulder to the grindstone and using our passion to push and make a difference and make a change and so forth. And the basic, you know, definition of desire in Buddhism is really wanting to make things different than they are. You know, craving is being out of balance. You know, whatever's going on, we want it to be different. Desire is the wanting of something to be different. There's a tension between what's happening and what we want to be happening. And that tension is something that we value as a means of changing things. Change what's out there to fit my desire. And that's what we do. We change the world in little and large ways to fit our wishes, our needs, our aspirations. And the Buddhist approach, which he seems to be arguing for, was that when there's a mismatch between the way things are and the way you want things to be, yes, one strategy could be to go out there and change things, but that's not really too likely to be successful. You know, the minute you get what you want something else, you know, or you want it to not slip away or whatever. And so he's offering this other alternative of adapting, changing your desires to meet with the way things are. When you're sitting in the hall here and your leg starts falling asleep or starts hurting or something, yeah, you could squirm around all 45 minutes to try to escape that tension of not liking the way it feels. Or you can just sit with it and observe it and watch how you don't like it. Watch how the discomfort changes and work with it in some way. That in this practice, we're trying to change ourselves somehow to adapt to the situation the way it is. Yes, my knee hurts, but I can't move for another 20 minutes. So I might as well just adjust, you know? This internal adjustment of our desires to meet what's happening is this alternative strategy to do away with the tension that's there, the disequilibrium. And we have to recognize that, you know, this word desire that I'm using comes in two modalities, positive and negative. So it's not just the craving to get what you want, but it's the craving of what you don't want to go away. The intolerance, the inability, the not liking the way something feels, the way it looks, the way it's situated. And so that not liking is a very strong desire for it to go away, desire for to pretend it's not there, to not look at it, to destroy it. So desire is in both a positive and negative way. So what I want to do, reason I call this the landscape of desires, I want to share with you a little bit some of the vocabulary that's used in the Buddhist text to talk about desire and see if we can begin to make some sense, you know, of this word and how to work with it. Does desire come in different flavors or modalities? Does it come in different intensities? Is the issue the various objects that can be what we have desire for or against? And I think there's something to all of those. A recent scholar sort of went through some translations of major Buddhist texts and asserts that 17 different Pali words are translated into English as desire, you know. And, you know, one might say that, you know, the Buddhists have more words for desire than the you know, indigenous population of northern climates have for snow, you know, and that's true. And so I want to explore that range of terminology for desire and see if it makes a difference what word we use in what context. And we'll start with the negative ones, because I think we've made some progress on this. I think maybe under the influence of Buddhism, maybe not. But I think there's some consensus that some of the very extreme forms of negative desire are maybe not okay, you know. Maybe we don't like all forms of desire. So, you know, the strong forms of hatred, you know, there's greed on the one side, which is strong wanting something, and then there's hatred on the other side, which is strong not wanting something. So can we at least acknowledge one of the words used for strong hatred is cruelty? Can we at least admit that cruelty is never okay, you know? That a very strong desire to hate something so much that you want to deliberately inflict harm and suffering on it, you know, that's an emotion, and it's on the spectrum of strong hatred. Can we at least acknowledge that that's not okay, that that's unhealthy, it's unwholesome, it's unskillful, it's unhelpful, it's unbeneficial? And then, you know, we back off a little bit from that. There's words for obsession, compulsion, you know, hating something so strongly that you'll be violent towards it, you know. Do we really valorize? Someday I'd like to go through great literature and find examples of all this, but one that comes to mind is Ahab. You know, Ahab, Captain Ahab, had so much hatred for the white whale that it was just driving him, obsessing him, compelling him to take these tremendous risks and eventually really lose his entire crew because of the force of his desire to get that whale, to put it, to kill it, you know. All right, so that's not okay. So what about strong hatred, you know? Or is there a sort of a healthy hatred? Maybe even a mild hatred. We might call it aversion, you know, or even just a very slight hatred. We might call something like annoyance. Annoyance is on the hatred spectrum, negative desire. Annoyance is something that you just kind of don't like. It's not like you hate it, but you don't like it at least a little. Of course, then there's strong annoyance, which can be, you know, even stronger. So even in English, if we look at the various words that we have for the negative forms of desire, there may be some sense in which we agree, or the dominant paradigm agrees, that some forms of that are not okay and some forms of that are okay. The dominant paradigm would say a certain amount of aversion is a healthy thing. There's such a thing as healthy hatred. Certain things it's okay to hate. You know, we hate people that are cruel. We hate people that perpetrate injustice. We hate ideas and things that cause harm. And that hate is okay because it's justified. Then on the other side, the positive side, you know, what is the strongest form of greed? You know, again, what if you feel like you don't just want something. You don't just want something a lot, but you need something. You know, maybe the kind of compulsion, the kind of obsession that drives addiction. You know, if you want something so bad that you have to have it, and in order to get it, you're willing to do almost any amount of harm to yourself or others, maybe we can agree that's not okay. That maybe there are some forms of greed, of desire. Again, we'll use the most innocuous word, desire. There's some forms of desire that on the far end of the spectrum go too far. And maybe we at least all agree that certain kinds of addicted, compulsive, obsessive behavior is not healthy. It's not good for us. But then we back off on that spectrum a little bit. Well, what about strong desire? I mean, what's wrong with passion? you know, as long as it's not over that edge? Or is there a healthy range of healthy desire? Or what about very mild desire? In Pali, there are words for, you know, delighting in something or having a preference for something. What's wrong with having preferences? What's wrong with preferring something over something else, desiring it a little bit? Maybe there's a range in which these emotions are just fine as long as they don't get too extreme. But they're not okay, any of them, if they get too extreme. So maybe it's a matter of intensity. Maybe it's a vertical scale, not a horizontal scale. Maybe the issue is that, you know, mild or slight desire, incremental desire is okay. And mild desire is okay too. And healthy desire. And it's only when it becomes overwhelming, when we're no longer in control, when the desire controls us, that it's not okay. So maybe we'll agree with the Buddha that using a strong word like craving, we can acknowledge there are certain kinds of desire that cause a lot of suffering. That suffering is not okay. So if that desire is the cause of that suffering, then if we can work to relinquish or get rid of that desire, those kinds of desire, then that's okay. But outside of that comfort zone, there's a whole another bunch of desires that we don't want to get rid of. We don't really don't get it that they're not healthy, that they're not harmful. So maybe the issue is the intensity. Maybe it's the different flavors of desire for both positive and negative. Maybe the issue is simply the object of that desire. Certain things are okay to really want or really hate. And certain things aren't, you know? So it's okay to have passion for justice and passion for kindness, even passion for awakening, you know? How can you get awakened if you don't have passion, if you don't desire awakening? Surely that's got to be a good part, desire. So maybe desire itself isn't the issue, but it's the object of desire. Maybe this is where wisdom comes in, you know? Wanting something selfish seems okay until you're wise enough to realize that it's actually not okay. You know, so maybe wanting is okay and hating is okay as long as we want and hate the right things, you know. That's one way to look at it. The way this is understood traditionally in the teachings of Buddhist psychology and of interdependent arising, he parses in on this fairly closely and fairly narrowly. There's a very good model, a very tight model of what exactly is happening in the mind moment by moment at the interface of desire, where desire is manifesting. So, you know, we all have consciousness. Consciousness is just the ability to be aware of something, to notice something, to know something. The consciousness comes in these six different modalities: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking, corresponding to the six sense spheres of the body. And that there are several things that naturally occur in any given mind moment, and it's, you know, there's nothing pathological about it. It's entirely natural. One is this consciousness that is dependent upon the body in some way. Then there's a part of the mind, there's a whole function of the mind that rationally thinks things through, that cognitively comes up with words and concepts and ideas and manipulates those to sort of come up with a cognitive model, a narrative, a story about what's happening. But where the action really is in this issue that we're talking about tonight is between this function of feeling tone on the one hand and emotional response to the feeling tone on the other. In other words, what I'm describing here are the five aggregates. The body is one, the consciousness is a second, perception or interpretive function is a third. But the two key aggregates that we're working with is the feeling tone, that every moment, everything we see or hear or think or feel feels good or bad. It feels pleasant or unpleasant, that there's a valence to it. And then every single moment, the fifth aggregate, the final aggregate, is that every single moment we must come up with some sort of emotional response to what we're seeing or hearing or thinking, some sort of emotional response to what feels good or what feels bad. And that's really where the action is. And the way dependent origination puts it is that a feeling tone arises that's either pleasant or painful, and in response to that, an emotional response occurs. An emotional attitude develops. And generally, habitually, what happens is that when a pleasant sensation arises, the emotion of liking it or wanting it or desiring it comes up. And when something unpleasant or painful arises, the feeling tone doesn't feel good, it's natural that our emotional response to that is hatred or negative desire. Push it away, pretend it's not there, kill it, you know, get rid of it. And that's natural. That's the operating system that we're designed with, that probably all animals are. Pleasure, pain, reflex. Something's pleasant, we go for it. Something's painful, we run from it. You know, that's natural. And then based on that, we then sort of act it out. We either act in such a way that we pull towards us or grab onto or attach to or bring towards us what feels good, and desire is motivating that, or we push it away, we strike it, we hit it, we run from it. So there's the feeling tone, there's the emotion of desire one way or the other, and then there's acting it out, and that acting out leads to karma and all the rest of it. So one of the questions about the dominant paradigm, one of the features of the dominant paradigm that I would like to question is this notion that desire is necessary in order to initiate action. And this goes back to the Greek philosophers. I think it was Thomas Hobbes that really put the nail in the coffin when he made this sweeping statement that all human activity is motivated by desire. You know, these philosophers in the pre-Buddhist encounter days really started with the assumption that there's a self, there's a soul, there's an entity that has will, an agent that has will, and the whole question is how is that agent exercising that will? And so they came up with this idea that a person has to want something in order for anything to happen. So desire is the motivator of all action. But in this Buddhist model, is that really the case? The Buddha would say no. So the way the Buddha parses this is that you take that sliding scale of negative desire that I laid out, from really harsh to mild, not liking to, you know, very gentle annoyance on the one hand, and you take the sliding scale that I laid out for the positive desire, from really needing and being addicted to something to just sort of liking it a lot to preferring it. But when you put those two ends together, the thin ends together, do they touch? In other words, does the positive desires flow smoothly into the negative desire, and we're always in one or the other of those modes? That's what we assume. But as I understand the teaching of the Buddha, his precise psychology, there's actually a gap between those. That they're all on the same continuum, from very much liking to very much disliking, very much wanting to very much not wanting, greed and hatred. But in the middle, there's a fairly large territory that's neutral. In other words, it's possible that our emotional responses are merely functional. They're doing what's appropriate in any given moment, such as initiating action, without that action being rooted in or co-arising with the notion of desire. In other words, we can do things instinctively, like, you know, when our knee gets hit and the leg goes out, you know, we didn't get involved with that. We can do a lot of things unconsciously that we respond to. You know, it's time to open the door. So you put your hand out and you know, you don't want to, you know, reach out and turn that handle. You know, you don't need to. You're not driven to. It's just a conditioned response. You know, you come to a door, you open it, you know, things like that. That there's an awful lot, when you look closely, both as the social scientists start looking closely at, you know, behaviorism and how we behave the way we do, and when neuroscience start looking at the sort of architecture of the brain and what functions are there and not there, it's beginning to be apparent that an awful lot of what we do is done on automatic pilot. It's done by habit, it's done by reflex. The little man, the little homunculus that the, you know, modern philosophers thought were in there pushing the buttons and pulling the levers isn't really there. But in some circumstances, when we open the door, we can bring a lot of strong positive and negative desire to it. In other words, the desire is a sort of an optional overlay that may or may not be there. It doesn't have to be there, the way Thomas Hobbes and so many others initially said. And this opens up a whole lot of interesting possibilities. Now, one of the great formulations of Buddhist psychology is the Abhidharma. Abhidharma, a slightly later body of literature, but it's rooted in the early teachings. But it, as it develops over some centuries, it brings more and more subtlety to the psychological model of how the mind and body works. And in that model, I think there's an answer to our question of must the Buddhist sort of condemnation of desire be something that we have to buy into, given the fact that we are enamored with many forms of desire. I think the solution is in this model. And so I'd put it this way, the way the Abhidharma puts it, there's certain mental functions that happen all the time. They're universal. There's certain things the mind does, such as create feeling tones and create perceptual interpretations of the data that comes in, of cognizing the object with consciousness. There's certain things that always have to happen in order for a minimum level of mental coherence to occur. And then there are some things that are merely functional. There's some functions that we do, including one called sort of an urge or an impulse. And this is what I think initiates action. And so we can reach out and open the door without a sort of higher level emotional desire kicking in. We do it just functionally. And there are a number of other ones that are functional, which I'll get into. Another one of them is determination or decision, that the ability to make decisions and to initiate action, that is not rooted in greed or hatred. It's not rooted in these healthy or unhealthy parts of the mind. Another one is energy. We can put forth energy or not when we do an action. Energy does not need to be driven by desire. We can put forward energy because it's the right thing to do. You know, we do what we have to do. We do what's appropriate and so forth. And so there's an awful lot of the mind that functions at a very autonomous level almost. There's a kind of default mode network where the mind kind of sort of goes on idle much of the time. It can generate some of the functions needed to act and initiate action and engage with behaviors and so forth. And then, however, there's this third layer, which is filled with unhealthy and unskillful motivations and attitudes and emotions. And when something like, you know, anger or hatred or desire or avarice or cruelty, when those emotions emerge, they dominate, they take over, they hijack the more simple part of the brain. So in other words, you can initiate an action in a neutral mode, or you can initiate that same action with the added energy, the added impetus of these strong emotions. You know, I'm reaching out for this doorknob because I hate the person behind it and I'm going to kill him. Or I'm reaching out for this doorknob because I'm so excited about what find out what's behind door number 3 because I'm going to win it, you know, that kind of thing. or not. So there's a whole host, there's 14 different mental factors, mental states that are unhealthy, that cause harm, that cause suffering. When any of these 14 factors are present, and two of them are greed and hatred, a third one is delusion, of course, and there is other subsections of those. When any of those are present, the brain has been hijacked, and this ability to do things is now driven by the negative desire or the positive desire. So in those circumstances, that's what the Buddha is pointing to. He's saying that's what's doing the harm. When our actions, our karma, is driven by these very primitive, very reflexive, very toxic emotions of deeply hating or deeply being greedy about something. And that's what he's trying to back us away from. He's saying don't do anything in the world. He's saying don't do anything with this kind of avarice, with this kind of cruelty, with this kind of harmful thinking, because that's causing suffering for other people and for yourself. So we're trying to purge our action of its toxic qualities. We're not trying to take it away altogether. And by the same token, there's another group of factors, more, 29 of them instead of 14. And these 29 factors are healthy. They're helpful. You can do the action with or without them. But when you do them with it, then you're actually generating beneficial deeds. You're doing good karma. You're creating things that are healthy for yourself and others. And among these positive emotions that we can bring to what we're doing is, first of all, mindfulness. Mindfulness is just a mental function. It's either operative or it's not. When it's not, we may be doing something, but we're not doing it with this equanimous awareness. Another of them is non-greed and non-hatred. Those are two other of the primary beneficial emotions that we have. Greed means things like generosity. You know, if we do something that's merely functional, that's one thing. If we do it with an attitude of generosity, of wanting to give, of wanting to help, of caring, that brings a different quality to a karmic quality to what is done. And the same thing with non-hatred. Non-hatred is metta, it's loving kindness, it's compassion. It's caring for and wanting the well-being of others. So I think I've exhausted my doorknob example. I don't know how that's going to be done with generosity and loving kindness, but you get the idea. So as I understand it, what the Buddha is basically saying is that the thing that he's condemning, that he sees us doing all the time and causing harm for ourselves and others, is we're functioning in the world, the basic models of mind and body interacting with cause and effect, with the environment around it. There's this activity always happening. That's what we do. But when that is overlaid with a host of negative emotions, that's when we're causing harm. When we do it with anger and annoyance and cruelty and resentment and jealousy and vengeance, all these words, we're doing what we're doing, and that emotional energy, if you will, is in a mental realm, never mind the physical realm, causing harm. There are causes and effects within the psychology from one mind moment to another that is leading us towards more and more suffering, and that's acting more and more as an obstacle to our ability to see things clearly and to behave well. And that's what he keeps saying we have to diminish. We have to pull out the dart. We have to put out the fire. We have to remove the poison of those toxic emotional states. Not all emotions, just the ones that cause harm and that are unhelpful. And further, he says, there's a bunch of beneficial states that we actually want to encourage. Practice means practicing mindfulness, practicing kindness, practicing generosity. We want the mind to function moment to moment with the overlay. We want it to be hijacked by all these positive states so that moment after moment we can be generating beneficial karma, beneficial patterns of cause and effect within the mind and body and by extension within the world around us. So that's my basic point, that there are ways in which we think about desire that are quite different from the way that the Buddha thinks about desire. And the kinds of desires that we like and want to preserve may be innocuous up to a certain point. And the kinds of things that the Buddha's teachings are saying we need to eradicate actually appear to be beneficial to us or appear to be innocuous to us in some cases, but are actually doing more harm than we realize. And so what we need to do is reinterpret. We have to broaden and expand somewhat our understanding of how desire is interacting with action in such a way that it becomes optional. That not desiring in toxic ways does not mean that we don't care, does not mean that we're disengaged. In fact, the way the texts talk about it, it's really the opposite, that when we get those negative toxic emotions out of the way, it allows us to be more fully present, more authentic, more in contact with things as they actually are, and less sort of clouded by our overlays, our conceptual and emotional overlays to the situation. So one thing I want to share with you, which I brought with me, which contributes to this conversation a little bit, is as many of you know, I'm originally a scholar of Buddhism, so I'm very interested in these texts and in working with them in their primary language. And what I have with me here is the Kama Sutta, that the Buddhists wrote a text, a sutra on Kama. You may be familiar with the Kama Sutra in Sanskrit, which is a little different from this one. It's a little longer. This one's only 6 stanzas. And this Kama Sutta, or discourse on sense desire, is not teaching us exotic ways to amplify sense desire, but is rather addressing to the issue of what is sense desire and how does it operate and in what ways is it harmful and in what ways can we work with it in beneficial ways. And so I want to share with you this because there's so much richness in every word, in every phrase that he uses in the early text that I want to try to bring some of those out and share them with you. So first, this word kama. Kama is one of the 17 words that can be translated as desire. I suspect there's more than 17, but those are the major ones. Sometimes in English translation, we simply see it translated as desire. Sometimes we see it as sense desire, that there's something sensory in particular about it. Among the different kinds of desire, this is very sort of primal sensual desire, sensory desire, that is desire that comes from contact with the sense objects themselves. And of course, it also, as in Sanskrit, it has a sexual overlay as well, an interpretation that in particular the sensory desires it's referring to is sexual. But in this case, it's important to distinguish that it's not the pleasure itself that comes from the sensual engagement that the Buddhists are condemning as harmful. It's the wanting of them. In other words, pleasure itself is not a problem. It's the wanting of the pleasure that's a problem. Now, within the 5 aggregate model that I mentioned to you, every moment there's going to be a pleasant or an unpleasant feeling tone. Things are going to feel good or bad, and shades of neutral as well. And every moment there's going to be an emotional response. But the feeling tone is hardwired. There's nothing you can do about it. The Buddhist teaching is not about how to transform pain into pleasure. It's not about how to make sure that we get pleasure all the time. It's not about how to make pain stop. Even though the word for pain is dukkha, it's a different level of dukkha than the First Noble Truth. Matter of fact, one of the important teachings of the early texts is that pain is inevitable. Pleasure and pain are part of the sensory apparatus, part of the mind and body, and there's no way to avoid them. That they're like the winds that blow, the worldly winds, the eight worldly winds. Among them are pleasure and pain. No matter what happens throughout your life, you're always going to have pleasure and pain. So the issue is not how to avoid one and pursue the other. The issue is how to work skillfully with both. In other words, how to be with pleasure without getting carried off into wanting and addiction, and how to deal with pain without fear, without running away, without trying to resist it or block it out or pretend it's not there, because that actually amplifies the suffering that comes from it. So the pleasure and pain is inevitable and hardwired, but the emotional response, some kind of emotional response, is also required every single moment. But among the range of emotional responses we have, some are helpful and some are unhelpful. This is where the sort of skillfulness comes in to how you work with experience. How do we accept the pain that it's there and find a way to be with it without resenting it, without feeling sorry for ourselves, without wishing it wasn't happening? Or how do we experience the pleasure without getting caught by it, without being seduced by it, without being entangled and drawn in such that we can't help but want more of it? And of course, the answer to that, the antidote to greed and hatred, is mindfulness. Because mindfulness brings this positive set of emotions with it, chief of which is equanimity. Equanimity is one of those positive emotions. So every moment of mindfulness is also a moment of equanimity. And by equanimity, we simply mean that we are experiencing the object, whatever it is, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, or thought. We're experiencing the feeling tone that goes with it, pleasant or painful or neutral, with an attitude of even-mindedness. Equanimity means neither favoring nor opposing. This is what's actually happening right now. I don't want it or need it to be anything other than it is. When your mind goes in harmony with what's happening, rather than trying to make something else happen, either positive or negative, that's when we experience the cessation of suffering. Because suffering is the very activity of wanting something different. When you don't want something different, you're not suffering. And so the practice of mindfulness, the practice of equanimity, the practice of the other things, loving kindness, generosity, all of these things help us be with what's happening without wanting to change it. Anyway, so this text I mentioned is just six stanzas. First one. If someone yearning for pleasure is successful at getting it, of course they have a joyful mind, since they get what a mortal wants. So that's the first point. Now, in Pali, these are masculine nouns. I always translate in the neutral gender now, if I can. So it's not that he has a joyful mind, but they have a joyful mind. It's not in the plural, but you know what I mean. People yearning for pleasure. This word for desire, it's not the pleasure itself, it's the yearning for pleasure. And even that word yearning has a little edge to it, you know. Is there really positive yearning? You could yearn for something positive, yearning for world peace, you know. But the experience of yearning really incorporates a sense of not being okay with the way things are, of putting energy into wanting something to be different. So it's the yearning for pleasure that is being generated. And then the issue is, what is the outcome of that? If a person is successful, if the thing that you want, you actually get, then you're happy, a joyful mind, piti mano. And they add this phrase, of course they have a joyful mind. That's the way the world works. We want things. we get them, and we're happy. So a person gets what they want. And they use the word mortal here because all people are the same. This is universal to human nature. There's nothing wrong with desire as long as it gets fulfilled all the time, right? If we always get what we want, then we're quite happy with it. We're even willing to do a little bit of yearning, you know. There's a certain anticipation, you know, for the pleasure that's going to come, if you're sure it's going to come, you know, the next episode of, you know, your favorite program. You can yearn for it for a couple of days, you know, knowing you're going to get it or so forth. Second stanza, but if those pleasures slip away, then the person yearning for them, the one creating the desire, is hurt as if stabbed by a knife. So there's a lot going on in just those four lines. Stabbed by a knife. This is the dart. This is the arrow. This is the toxic quality of the desire. It hurts. You're piercing yourself. But notice, what you're being pierced with is not pain. They're not saying the pain hurts like a knife, cuts like a knife. They're saying that the yearning for pleasure is what cuts like a knife. In other words, the pangs of desire, you know. Remember what it was like when you were a teenager and you were desperately in love with someone, you know, and you couldn't have them? That hurts, you know, and there's a lot of things like that. Notice that the pleasures slip away. That phrase is just, it's not that you know, pleasure is unattainable. We do attain the pleasure. The problem comes from the moment of satisfaction that comes from getting what we want is immediately followed by the stab because it slips away. We don't want it to slip away. We desire it to continue and so forth. And notice also the phrase, the one creating the desire. In other words, the desire is not inherent. Desire is not a natural part of the natural world. Rocks and trees don't desire things. We can anthropomorphize them, say the tree is happy there because it likes the sun. But only humans and perhaps animals have this mechanism for desire. In other words, it's something that people do. It's not something that's a natural part of the world. So they're recognizing that the desire is being created. So you really want something, it slips away, and it hurts like a knife because you're making it hurt like a knife. If you weren't creating the desire, then pleasure slipping away wouldn't be an issue. When you're practicing mindfulness with equanimity, pleasures and pains come and go, and it's not an issue. You expect that. You sit down on the cushion, you expect things to feel good now and then, and things feel bad now and then, and that's all part of the game. You notice when it feels good, you notice when it feels bad, and ideally, you're not being jerked around by that. It's not like, I hate this, I love this, I want this, I don't like that. You know, we're not spending this 45 minutes on this huge emotional roller coaster most of the time. Sometimes we are. But the idea is to just learn how to be in the peaceful center of all kinds of things coming and going and not create the desire. A moment of mindfulness is a moment of non-desire. A moment of equanimity is a moment of being with whatever's happening. It doesn't mean you approve it. It doesn't mean, well, pain in the knee is really a good thing. I wish there was more of it. I wish everybody could feel it. It's not like that. It's just, this is what's happening now. And so you're aware of it. And that awareness is not hijacked by not wanting it, not liking it. So the desire is something created that you either do or not do. And that's where the skill comes in. When we're constantly creating various emotional afflictions that then assail us in strong or weak forms and make us unhappy and suffering, that's the condition the Buddha is trying to help cure us from. And in those moments when we can be with what's happening with enhanced awareness, enhanced attentiveness, enhanced understanding of that being the way it is, the better off we'll be. Third stanza. One who circumvents pleasures And here, comma is the word. So I would almost say one who circumvents the yearning for pleasures, like the head of a snake with one's foot. That mindful one, while in the world, evolves beyond this attachment. So they're using this image of avoiding a snake. There's a lot of them in ancient India, you know. If you see a snake in the road, you walk around it. Doesn't mean you hate it. Doesn't mean you're afraid of it. You just do what's appropriate. So the same thing for the yearning for pleasures, you know. Think of it like a snake. It's potentially harmful. This yearning for something that I want, given the fact that things that I want slip away, I'm only setting myself up for some kind of hurt. I'm going to start stabbing myself with that knife again. So an intelligent person simply walks around it. You're not avoiding pleasure. You're avoiding yearning for pleasure. You're avoiding the desire, not the object. That's an important distinction that we often don't get. And then they bring in this word mindfulness. The person is mindful while in the world. So this phrase has all three words. Evolving while in the world, evolving beyond the world. Evolving beyond attachment. This word evolving, samativattati, it's like turning together in a way that overcomes something. And I think fundamentally, that's what the Buddha is teaching us. How do we evolve to the sort of the next stage of human evolution? Yes, we are rooted in primal instincts that automatically pursue pleasure and avoid pain. But we can evolve through the cultivation of mindfulness and equanimity and the gradual stepping away from these more primitive, more toxic emotions. We can evolve into a sort of person that uses their mind fully and intelligently and wisely, but without limiting it by the obsessive wanting or hating of things. In other words, the emotional states, the beneficial and the toxic ones, are kind of coloring the quality of consciousness every moment. And it's either coloring them in ways that are harmful, and then not seeing clearly and acting out of passion and acting reflexively because it feels justified, that's what's getting everybody into so much trouble. And being able to instead act in ways that understand what's happening, understand impermanence, understand selflessness, be equanimous, be kind, be generous, be caring. The more and more we act like that, we're cultivating that part of our nature. So the Buddha is saying that these sort of toxic parts of our human nature we want to allow to gradually dissipate, and these more evolved, more beneficial, more helpful parts of our human nature, both individually and collectively, we want to try to cultivate and develop. And it's all put in this framework of evolution. Attachment is natural. It's instinctive. It's part of the world. But we can evolve beyond that attachment. Whenever we act automatically or rooted in attachment, we're causing harm one way or the other. Next stanza, for one who is greedy, and then they list, it could be for land, for goods, gold, cattle, horses, serving men, women, or kinfolk, or many other pleasures, sense desires. When one is greedy, then the list, their weakness only gets stronger. In other words, that which weakens them, these toxic states, strengthen, and they become more and more toxic. They learn to become a person more disposed to hatred, more disposed to anger, more disposed to harming others. They get crushed by many troubles, and suffering flows in on them like water in a leaking ship. So this is the next metaphor. Now the suffering is like water. And it's not like a flood, the tidal wave that just comes and drowns you. It happens little by little. We often don't even see it happening. We're gradually bringing more and more discontent into our lives because we're annoyed by more and more things, because we're just drifting in the direction of wanting things to be like this and not like that, you know? And that's what he's saying. It's very subtle and it's very gradual, but it is insidious. And like water on a sinking ship, it will inevitably take you to the bottom, you know? So the final stanza, thus a person ever mindful, steers themselves away from the attachment to pleasures, away from the yearning for pleasures, steers themselves away from kama. Bailing ship, they abandon them, and crossing the flood, they go beyond. So in this last stanza, we get this notion of bailing the ship. Every moment of mindfulness is a moment of letting go of the suffering that was accumulating from you wanting things to be different than they are. Anyway, so the final challenge for us in all of this is just that that phrasing of accepting things the way they are automatically makes us think in the dominant paradigm, well, that means that the Buddha is encouraging us to accept the injustices of the world, to accept the bully who's picking on someone, to not do anything and sort of back out of things. And I resist that interpretation. I think what the Buddha is telling us, by all means, use your wisdom, use your compassion, use your understanding to make yourselves, your lives, and your neighbors and the world a better place, but do it with an attitude of, have the motivation rooted in kindness, in compassion, in generosity, rather than have it rooted in fear, rooted in hatred. You know, I want to change this because that person is so bad, I hate them. And, you know, the trouble with hatred and anger is they work. All these unhealthy emotions are very effective. They will bring about the end chosen. You can use anger to defeat an enemy. You can use hatred to purge the world of certain, you know, terrible things. You can use greed to get you something that maybe is beneficial for yourself and others. But Buddhism is not concerned with succeeding at our tasks, despite the co-opting of mindfulness for that in the corporate world these days. Buddhism is concerned with the quality of your mind at any given moment and to help evolve the quality of your mind from one that's afflicted by all kinds of self-imposed sufferings to one that's skillful and capable of healing itself and others through a wiser and more beneficial way of working. So by all means, let's change the way things are, but with an attitude of being okay with them as they are, if you can understand that distinction. Anyway, thank you for your attention. I want to leave time for some questions and comments. We have about 10 minutes.